Counsel, are you prepared for the telephone argument in U.S. v. Morgan? This is Judge Kleinfeld.
Yes, Judge, I am.
Thank you. Do we have counsel for both sides on there?
Michael Morris, the government, Your Honor.
Thanks. Okay, we'll hear from appellant.
Judge, I'm having is other counsel on the phone?
Counsel for the government is present in the courtroom. You wouldn't have heard because he wasn't at the podium, but...
Okay, thank you very much.
But he's present, and all three judges are on the bench.
Understood, and thank you. Good morning. My name is Nancy Hinchcliffe, and I'm the attorney for Appellant Lonnie Morgan. I'm an attorney in Phoenix, Arizona, and I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to argue telephonically. As the court is aware, Mr. Morgan was convicted of an assault with a deadly weapon, a bat. His conviction was affirmed on appeal, and he filed a 2255 petition, which was summarily denied. The issue that has been certified is whether Morgan was denied his right to effective assistance of counsel due to trial counsel's failure to present exculpatory evidence. Now, this
counsel, let me tell you what was on my mind when I studied this case.
Great.
This is Judge Kleinfeld. It looked to me as though the prosecution put on a really, really weak case. They didn't put on the victim. They put on the little girl who basically said that the defendant didn't do it. And with that weak a prosecution case, a lot of good defense lawyers would have just rested and decided to take their chances on the old BRD, as we used to call it in defense work.
Yeah.
In addition, as for putting on the wife's testimony, that the defendant, or I don't remember, wife, common law wife, girlfriend, doesn't matter.
Ms. Ogo.
Her testimony that the defendant did not hit her. The judge said, if you do, I'm going to let the frightening Dr. Ferraro testify. We see the same experts in case after case.
Certainly.
And I'm thinking, boy, that'd sure scare me out of it. So, because Ferraro always testifies that the man is guilty.
Yes.
So between the case being so weak, I can't see why it's ineffective assistance of counsel to just let a lot of things go and take his chances.
Can I address that?
Please do.
All right. I want to pick up on something that you just said to me, because it's very true, as defense counsel, many times we are faced with a case where we really have no witnesses. We have really nothing substantive to present. Our case is basically based upon cross-examination to poke holes in the state's case and rely upon some good argument. And that's what we rely upon in a case to show that, in fact, there is reasonable doubt. Your Honor, this really isn't that case. Not at all. Now, I have filed a very lengthy brief here. I hope it's not one that was filed ad nauseum. It was filed to show you to try to help the court and assist the court to show you why it is there's ineffective assistance here, and let me be specific. I'm not going to go through all the details of all the witnesses, because that's been set forth, and I know the court's read and aware of all of it. There's one issue, if nothing else this morning, that I would like to stress its importance, because I think that counsel failed to present this, and it segues into the importance of Smith's testimony and Washington's testimony, and that's timing. Timing was extremely important in this case, and here's why. There is no doubt in this case that there were two 911 calls made from Ogo's residence. The first one was made undisputed about 4:30 in the morning. The second one was made at 7:55 in the morning. The dispatchers testified as to this, and when it comes to Deputy Kennedy, and Deputy Kennedy was the officer that talked to Ogo at about 4:46 in the morning, there's no doubt that the person who was on the line talking to the dispatcher was Lonnie Morgan. There is no doubt that Lonnie Morgan was at this lady's residence when the 911 call was made. Now, this is significant in terms of helping us to decide when this assault, if it happened, occurred. And that's why it's important, since we know that he was there at that time in the morning, that we understand the significance of the testimony of Smith and Washington. because we know when Deputy Kennedy got there, and we know she says she got there at 4:46 in the morning, so 15 minutes after Lonnie's on the phone at that from that residence talking to the dispatcher, we know he's not there anymore. He has left. When Deputy Kennedy arrives, Deputy Kennedy talks to this woman, and she's not injured. She's not complaining about any threats. Nothing has happened. Well, what does that mean? Why is that important? That's important in terms of the timing of these events for these reasons. We know from Smith's testimony that he says he took Lonnie Morgan over there at about 4:15, 4:30 in the morning. We know from the sister, Washington, that she says Lonnie arrived at her place at about 4:50 a.m. in the morning. So what, you may say to me? Well, I would direct your attention to an excerpt of record. It's at 212. It's a little bit faint on the number, but I believe it's 212. And what this is the police report of Deputy Acton. Deputy Acton is the police officer who talked to this woman and spoke to her later on in the morning at about after the 7:55 a.m. Phone call is made, and there's the complaint, and she arrives, Deputy Acton arrives, and she's talking to Ogo, and Ogo says, I've been injured, and she has been injured. She's got injuries. The significance of the report is found when it says, and this is about the second paragraph, it says at 4 o'clock hours, now this is an interview of Ogo, and she's talking on the day this happens, right after the 911 call at 7:55, she's telling Deputy Acton at 4 o'clock hours, a friend dropped Morgan off at the residence. She then says, I was assaulted, and she goes in the details of what happened. So she, in essence, is telling Deputy Acton that shortly after this friend drops this person off, this assault takes place. Now, remember, you have Deputy Kennedy there at 7:46. My client is gone. According to what Smith has to say and what Washington has to say, Smith says, I dropped him off there at 4:15, perhaps 4:30.
But you know what Dr. Ferrara is going to testify. She's going to testify that wherever the woman says anything exonerating about the man, the woman is covering up for him. And wherever she says anything that implicates the man in a crime, that's the truth. And even if she doesn't, the man is guilty.
Judge, I failed in my mission because I haven't been clear, and I apologize to the court. This is long before she would have had an opportunity to fabricate. At the point when she is,
it's not just fabrication. Dr. Ferrara will say, as those experts generally do, that people recast these things in their own mind and feel a need to blame themselves and excuse others.
Judge, I hear what you're saying, and I must say I've never had benefit of listening to this lady's testimony, but I understand the gist of what you're saying.
I've never listened, but I've read transcripts.
Right. I haven't read those transcripts, but I understand the court's point. But I don't think it makes sense in what I'm trying to tell you. Because
well,
this
problem, Ogo testified that the first call, her husband came over at 2 a.m., and that's when Kennedy was there, so she did. She certainly got her times mixed up because the time of the call to the dispatcher wasn't until 4:30.
Judge, you're absolutely right. You're right. She did say she has these two calls at about 2. She's got 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. In her mind, when she has indicated that these two phone calls were at 2 and 4, we know that's wrong. We don't have to depend upon her word for that. We don't have to depend upon my client's word for that. We know that those calls, in fact, were made, when I said earlier, approximately 4:32, 4:30 in the morning, and 7:55. But I want to get back to the first judge's comments to me, because I think it's key to this case. I'm hearing some bleed over on the line, but in any event, this is my point. This is on the date of 10/27/96. When she's mad at this client and she's reporting to the police that she's just been horribly assaulted by him. She's angry at him. She's mad at him. She wants him prosecuted. She wasn't trying to recant and protect him at that point. This is at 7 in the morning on the day this happened. This is before she's decided to recant, much later at the detention hearing when, for the reasons that Ferraro would state, all these psychological factors kick in and she's decided now that she wants to protect him. So when you say to me that, you know, that this is insignificant, I say to you, Your Honor, that that's not true. In this particular situation, this is a police report. Again, it's 212. This is her report to the police that morning before she's had any thoughts of recanting. That's my
point.
Would
this report all be true except for the times?
Are you asking me if it's all true in terms of...
No, I'm saying, is it logical that it could all be true except that the woman is mixed up on times?
Oh, well, she's mixed up on times, and I think that's really irrelevant. I think. Let's face it. None of us look at, you know, if you're in a situation like this, you may not be looking at the clock. I'm not holding it against the lady or saying she's a liar because she says 2 and 4. She's made a mistake on the time. Instead of pinning it to 2 and 4, we know the exact times. We know there's two instances, so it's at 4:30 and it's at 7:55. But everybody else in this case, the deputies, Smith, Washington, are talking about it in terms of the first phone call and the second phone call. And so that's my point.
She tells you what's happened at 4:30, though. That was the second visit as far as her recollection is concerned, because she said the first visit was at 2, didn't she? So I'm not sure how irrelevant it was.
Okay, and I, you know, again, I failed in my mission because I understand the court's position, and let me tell you why. Perhaps more than focusing on the exact time, the sequence, because she's saying the assault occurred right after the friend dropped him off. And what I'm saying to you is that Smith says he dropped him off at 4:30. And she also told, at a later time, she told Williams, now this is later in time, but she mentioned to Williams, who was an investigator, I think for the defense, I'm not sure of that, but tells that a friend, in fact, this friend was, in fact, Smith, and that immediately after Smith drops Lonnie off is when this confrontation, or assault, if we will, takes place. So regardless of whether we pin it down at 2 or at 4, this is a situation where the significance is the timing of it in terms of the assault is occurring soon after the friend drops this person off. And we know that Smith says that he dropped this person, that he dropped my client off at approximately 4 o'clock, or excuse me, 4:15, 4:30 in the morning. We know a 911 call comes in at that time. We know that for sure. We also know for sure that Lonnie's on the line. We also know for sure that he's gone by the time the officer gets there.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel?
Michael Morrissey for the government. Let me attempt to take Dr. Ferraro out of this case right away, because I think that there were very good tactical reasons why Amy Ogo, the victim, was not going to be called by the defense. Judge Broomfield made a finding. He said at page 100 of the transcript on April 9, 1997, referring to the mother's interference with Nicole, the daughter's testimony, that in his 26 years on the bench, he had never before seen direct evidence of subornation of perjury. Perjury permeated the victim's testimony. Furthermore, the thrust of the victim's testimony was going to be, my bad, I was on alcohol, I was on cocaine. That was going to be nearly a ridiculous comment to put forth in light of the fact that Deputy Sheriff Kennedy at 4:30 said she showed no signs of alcohol and no signs of cocaine. Later, at 7:50, Firefighter Essex, who had medical training, said that there was, and this is at page 142 of his testimony, she was not under influence of stimulants and she was not under the influence of alcohol. Further, Deputy Sheriff Acton said the same thing. So every objective witness who saw this victim said, no, she was not under the influence of alcohol or cocaine. For the mother victim to then get on the stand and say, yes, I was, in light of her recantation testimony, was going to be a time bomb of a problem for the defense and clearly justify tactically the decision not to put her on.
Oh, so you're saying independently of the risk in, that this case could go sour, the defendant would have been exposing himself to another felony case?
I don't think I'm saying that, but maybe I am. I don't understand the thrust of
perjury.
Not the defendant, the mother who didn't testify, because the defendant had his own issues. He had his trial, but the mother who recanted at the detention hearing then got a lawyer appointed because it was found by the magistrate judge to be clear problems with perjury. At trial, the district court, upon inquiry, because Nicole, the daughter, had to testify twice, because the first time she had problems. Upon inquiry, why did she have problems? Because I talked to my mom. And that's when Judge Broomfield said he'd never before seen direct evidence of subornation of perjury.
Well, supposedly the issue is whether they were going to get in her testimony at the detention hearing, wasn't it? I don't know on what basis they would have done that, but that seemed to be suggested here, that she was unavailable or something.
She was unavailable because the lawyer appointed for her made the representation that she would assert her Fifth Amendment rights, and therefore she was unavailable because she was in a trap. If she testified and said that I lied at the detention hearing, then she was exposing herself to liability. If she testified that actually the assault did happen, either way, under oath, once, she had lied, so she had that problem. So it really had very little to do with Dr. Ferraro, the tactical decision, and that was certainly not unreasonable. Let me also say on the time frames, counsel has simply misapprehended the record. What the victim mother said to Deputy Acton was, Morgan, the defendant, had returned to the house. There's no mystery how he got back to the house, because when he left the first time, and that's Deputy Kennedy at 4:30 and 4:46, she gave him the keys to her vehicle. That's at page 49 of the April 10th testimony. That's how he got back to the house. So clearly she was confused on time frames, but the important issue is the assault is the return time, the second time. Now dealing with the testimony of Nicole. I'm sorry.
Why did the district court deny any kind of an evidentiary hearing?
I think because truly there was no way there was either deficient performance or prejudice. And let me just quickly run through the specific allegations. Take Mr. Smith, that he should have been called as a witness.
Smith and Washington.
Okay. Well, let me deal Washington because that's even quicker. Washington says that she goes to sleep at 6:15 and she doesn't see the defendant thereafter. Well, if the assault is roughly at 7:50, because that's when 911 is called, then Washington has nothing that is helpful in any way. Now dealing with Smith, because of course you will judge this by counsel's performance at the time of trial. If this wasn't serious business, then the difference between what
Smith wasn't even interviewed prior to trial, right?
That's not true. That is categorically not true. And let me give you the cite for that, Judge. Smith, it's at page 205 of the excerpts of record, which is defendant's own exhibit, and defendant acknowledges that his counsel had interviewed Smith and that his counsel told defendant that Smith had nothing helpful. Is that objectively reasonable or true? Certainly it is, because at page 210 of the excerpts of record, exhibit 4, you see Smith's pretrial interview just before trial saying that he didn't remember anything else about that night, and that he didn't see anything, didn't see Lonnie with a bat. Two years after trial and almost 3 years after the incident, we get a long affidavit from Mr. Smith. And again, if this were not serious business, it would be comical how his testimony has now changed.
What was the page number where he says he didn't remember anything, didn't see anything?
That's ER 210, Defendant's Excerpts of Records, page 210. It memorializes the interview by the Bureau of Indian Affairs investigator. So Mr. Smith, as of the time of trial, didn't have anything helpful to the defense. That's Mr. Smith. Now we've also done Ms. Washington. Let's talk about Dr. Scott, okay?
Those are the ones I was concerned about.
Okay. just for my purposes, I need to mention Dr. Scott in case any of the other judges are concerned. Dr. Scott's statement about he would have expected the injuries to be more severe would have been relevant and very important if the crime had been assault resulting in serious bodily injury. But that wasn't the crime charge. The crime charge was assault with a dangerous weapon. And therefore, his equivocal statements as to not being able to rule a bad in and not being able to rule a bad out were not particularly helpful. And as Judge Kleinfeld pointed out earlier, it actually benefited the defense not to have the doctors there because it enabled the defense to argue that the government simply hadn't met its burden, that we didn't have a doctor testifying, we didn't have a victim testifying, that the government simply had not done its job and had not put evidence before this jury sufficient to convict. That may have been a persuasive argument if this case was tried 10 times. With this particular jury, it was not, and that's not the test. It's not whether or not you got a happy result. I would also point out that on the issue of the bat and Dr. Scott, the defense was able to establish through Deputy Acton that the confines were so small that you couldn't take a full swing, okay? Well, that also explains why the injuries might not have been as severe. So looking at this as of the time that the defense attorney was trying the case, these decisions were reasonable. Dealing lastly just with time frames again, Nicole said it was light out when Mom was hurt, when Mommy got hurt. That's at page 91 of April 9th. It's not light at 4:30. Nicole said that the Deputy Kennedy testified that it was dark at 4:46 when he went there. Deputy Acton and Firefighter Essex were there at 7:50 or 8 o'clock when it would be light out. And that's how you show that actually it is the second assault when it's light out that this occurred, and there is no time frame and there is no inconsistency. Unless the court has questions, I will cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. United States v. Morgan is submitted. Court is adjourned. Prior to the commencement of your argument. That's what the judge said. Prior to the commencement of.